You are listening to the cycling podcast at the Tour de France, in association with Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004. Today, we are in Salon de Provence.
Hello, my name is Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And Francois Thomazeau.
Hello, Richard.
Hello, chaps. Where are we, Lionel?
Well, we're in some kind of rugby stadium. Well, it is a rugby stadium. There's posts up here.
Artificial turf.
Which, rugby on an artificial turf.
Wouldn't fancy that.
Well, look, imagine all those grazed elbows and knees.
Well, it's very difficult to raise natural grass in Provence, actually, as you can tell by the heat that we have right now. So it's much cheaper, you know, to have artificial grass on a rugby pitch in Provence, unfortunately.
Well, we are in Salon de Provence, where this, well, what stage? The
19th
stage of the Tour de France finished. Yeah, real end of term feeling today, though, isn't there? Really. I mean, it feels like we're breaking up for summer. We're not. There's still 2 days to go. But it's been a slightly anticlimactic day on the Tour de France, I'd say. After all the sort of anticipation of the Alpine stages, I've said earlier on to Francois, this feels like a Jean-Marie Leblanc Tour de France, when Jean-Marie Leblanc was the race organiser throughout the 90s and most of the 2000s. There'd often be the end of the mountains.
A late transition stage, because often he was trying to take us up to Paris in you know, by bike rather than by car.
So you'd end up with a kind of a, well, a day for the breakaway. And to be fair,
and Max Chiandri would finish second.
Yeah. There haven't been many days for the breakaway. So, you know, can't begrudge the riders the opportunity to get up the road and contest the stage. But it's felt like the overall battle has been on, you know, it's been on hiatus today, pending tomorrow's time trial. We're not anticipating a sudden turnaround. Chris Froome, he's got the sort of, well, he's got the strongest, smallest grip on the yellow jersey
I can ever remember. Whoa. Getting a bit ahead of ourselves here. Are we not, Lionel? Talking about tomorrow. What about today's Tale of
the Etape? We're in the hometown of Nostradamus, so we're allowed to predict and look forward. Although he actually died here, and I've often wondered, did he see that coming?
Well, who knows? He probably did, yeah.
The Tale of the Etape. Well, I'll keep it very brief. There was a big breakaway. 20 riders were in it. Some big names in there, and really varied types of riders as well, because Thomas de Gendt was in there for Lotto Soudal. He's been off the front for around 30 hours of the Tour de France, which is quite extraordinary, really, but with no luck, unfortunately, for him. Also in there, some of the bigger names, Jan Bakalantz of AG2R, Lilian Calmejean, Ben Swift of UAE, Robert Kieselowski, Tony Gallopin, Bauke Mollema, Daniele Bernatti, Sylvain Chavanel. But it came down to quite an exciting finish. There was a split on a climb around 17 kilometres to go. That kind of split the group in half. And then it was all decided with 2.9 kilometres to go. There was a roundabout, the most important roundabout in France today, because most of the group went the left-hand side of the roundabout, but Edvald Boasenhagen and Nikias Arndt, they went the right-hand side of the roundabout and cut off a lot of road and made up a lot of ground. They then were away, and then Boasenhagen was very impressive in the final stages, dropped Arndt and soloed to a win when you could have forgiven him for perhaps waiting for the sprint. There were some dangerous men for the sprint. Jens Kukalera of Orica Scott would be one. Ben Swift, possibly, had he still made that split, would be another. But Boasenhagen took no chances and he got a thoroughly deserved stage victory 6 years
after his last one.
Yeah.
Nobody could argue with that at all. Boasenhagen really has deserved it. Steve Cummings, his teammate, was sitting this morning having a coffee with Matt Raben, who is a chiropractor on the Cannondale Drapac team, and he pointed at Boasenhagen and said, he will win today. Our producer, Adam Bowie, also thought he would have a very good chance today and used him in our Kilometre Zero that went out today. So there was somebody made the point, I can't remember who it was, that the break today wasn't like the breaks in the early stages when there were opportunities. These were strong riders who were capable of going with that break today on quite, you know, it wasn't an easy stage, but they were all strong riders. And Boasenhagen's been one of the form riders in the Tour, and he said, you know, he's gone so close, and you know, he's gone long the stage that he lost with the photo finish with Kittel. He'd gone pretty long there, and he is this hybrid of a sprinter, but he's also won on his own. I mean, the last Tour de France stage that he won into Pinerolo, he won on his own with a quite a long-range attack. So he's versatile, he's strong. He was, on paper, one of the fastest riders in that break, but didn't want to leave it to that. And I thought he was doing too much. We were watching it together, Francois, you and I, and I was convinced that Bösenhagen was just following everything, attacking a lot, and almost panicking a bit. And I wasn't convinced that he was going to have it at the finish.
Probably wary of Jens Kukerer, who actually won the well, kind of mini bunch sprint, you know, for third place. But he plays so cleverly. I mean, when you look at his career throughout his career, I mean, he's won all types of races actually, and he's a versatile rider, as you say. But so, some riders, like, well, I talked to Sylvain Chavanel after the stage. He said the problem these days is, you know, I'm not a climber, I'm not a sprinter, I'm a good rider. But these days in modern cycling, you have to specialize to win stages. It was fun. It was kind of strange that Chavanel should say that, because Bösenhagen never specialized. Actually, he's good when there's, you know, hilly climb. He should have won more classics. Actually, he had some of his potential has never been. I think he wasted a little bit of his potential, maybe by riding with Sky as a teammate for a long time. Maybe even today with Dimension Data, being a kind of a road captain. It's when you remember his first two seasons as a pro. I mean, he was winning everything.
The funny thing is, we would hardly have noticed him had Cavendish not crashed out, because
right,
he would have had a very different role. This is a point that was made actually by Roger Hammond, sports director at Dimension Data, who I spoke to at the finish. Here is Roger Hammond.
The Tour de France is one of those things where, you know, it's kind of a muted celebration until we get to Paris, but, you know, now we've got something to celebrate in Paris, something big, so that was, yeah, really nice. The only issue we had is that, you know, Eddie's the only guy that's come that's in a close proximity of Marcel Kittel in the sprint, so as a sports director, you have to try and put yourself in the shoes of the other people, and, you know, what would you do if you were any one of those other 20 riders? The last thing you'll do is come to the finish line with Eddie. I think he prayed it pretty well. Didn't look all that brilliant once we got 9 riders with 2 from Orica, but you know, if you're that strong, then you can quite often do whatever you want to do. And after 225k predominantly into headwind, I think just form came through in the end. It means a heck of a lot. I mean, the more it means to me is payback for actually the riders. You know, that's a huge setback. If you come with a rider like Mark for a stage race that's got 9 possible wins for him, and you lose him on the first one, then it's pretty easy for the team to have just sort of shut down and you know, felt sorry for themselves for 3 weeks. And I think we've shown every day that we haven't. We've been part of every breakaway in the mountains. We've been fighting in the bunch sprints. We've been dominating the leadouts. And I think for me, it made me really proud of the way the guys got up and got back up from adversity. And I think that's what professional bike rider is about, is having setbacks but getting up and fighting on. And they showed that with abundance through this Tour de France. And I just felt so sorry for them that they weren't getting the rewards that they deserved. Today they did. We prepare well. Obviously we had Mark coming in for the sprint stages, so a long time out. We've had a coach driving around France on his own with a video camera on the front of his car for the last 3 weeks. He's been sending those videos through to us, so we had a video live footage of the last 50k today. So we knew every single roundabout. So the notes on mine was 3.3 kilometers to go, left hand side, and then he just chose the right way. So it was absolutely perfect. I mean, but it's all about a team effort. Everybody. There's a lot of people put a lot of effort in, and you know, the rider has to do it at the end, but we'll claim it all. No, it's he was just so strong. I mean, go the other side of the roundabout, give the other guys a can't follow the wheel. It's tactically he did well. The trouble is, you come through the town and they're radio silent, so they're too afraid of calling the wrong result. So the race radio doesn't say anything, and then TV was really pixelated and broken up. So you kind of just got a frozen image of Eddie, and then just pixelation around the outside, so you couldn't really tell whether he's alone. And the only reason we knew it was in the finishing straight, and there was a motorbike behind him. And then once you could see the motorbike, you knew that there was, you know, another vehicle in there. It must have been big enough. But yeah, no, there's a lot of emotion come out, because, you know, it's been a very hard tour for the team. I mean, you know, we've had quite a lot of setbacks, and then, you know, it's been a roller coaster of emotion. You know, setback, come back, almost win, lose by 0.00 whatever it was, millionths of a second is almost nothing, but it's a massive gulf of difference in result. You know, second or a stage win in the Tour is second is nothing, stage win's everything. So you know, it's been a roller coaster, but roller coaster finally to get the big one.
Roger, this is the best we've seen Boston Hagen for some time. Is he doing anything differently this year?
Every cloud is a silver lining, and the cloud of Cav crashing and breaking his shoulder blade has been a silver lining of unexpected no pressure coming in. Freedom to race and you know, obviously in scintillating form, because we all had a big belief in Mark, you know, as we came to the tour, so everybody was ready to do it, and all of a sudden he's been able to use that form and have freedom, and I think that's I mean, he's always been a great bike rider, hasn't he? He's always has. It's just about freedom, you know, the Sky years, and then coming to us he was also got roped in a little bit to lead outs, but you know, here he had freedom and he's shown what a great bike rider he actually is.
Well, Roger Hammond there, adamant that the attack up the inside the roundabout was pre-planned. Not sure about that, because he had quite a lot of goes before then as well, so it wasn't that he was saving it all for that roundabout, but he did make the point that they'd obviously wrecked the course and they knew about that. And it was an opportunistic move and a good move, and what was so impressive about it was the way he just rode Nicky's Arndt, a fast finisher, off his wheel.
Yeah, I mean, how many metres did he gain by going the right hand side?
Very few. Very few.
10 or 15, but enough, probably. That's the difference, isn't it? When you've got a group going, you know, the speed they were going, and the other two going the speed they were going. I mean, there wasn't much in it in terms of the speed they were going, but it was just that the door opening just enough to let them get away. And that was, you know, it was smart, regardless of whether or not they knew in specific detail that was the best way to take the roundabout or not. I'll give them a benefit of the doubt on that. But even just seeing it, I'm assuming that, though, you know, the good riders take the shortest way around the corners, or not the shortest necessarily, but the fastest. It just so happens that was not only the fastest, but also the shortest.
Never forget the luck factor there. But in the same time, I have the impression that it was pre-planned, because I bumped into AG Touran team director Stéphane Goubert, who told me that he was in the car shouting at Jan Bakkelands, who was in this break, to take the roundabout on the right. So obviously most teams have, you know, at the briefing in the morning, had told their riders that if they came to the roundabout, you know, at the finish, they should take it by the right. But most of these riders had no clue they were going to be in the breakaway and in a position to win. So maybe, because even as Boston Hagen said...
So why did Bakkelands... I mean, the obvious thing to do always is to follow the wheel in front of you, but why did Bakkelands not go the other way, do you know?
Well, you didn't know. I mean, he couldn't say... He was kind of disappointed, saying, I kept screaming at him to do that, and he didn't. Probably find the flow. I guess Bakkelands, like Sylvain Chavanel, told me the same thing. They were all on Kukura's wheel, actually. So they probably believed he was a dangerous man.
Well, he had a teammate as well up there, Albasini. So Kukura won a hard stage in the Vuelta into Bilbao, didn't he? Which was basically a bunch sprint. So he very fast finished. There are a lot of fast guys there. So it was a hard one to call, and it made this potentially dull stage into quite an interesting one, because the battle for this stage was quite interesting. Lionel, did you speak to Ben Swift at the finish?
Yeah, I did. Obviously, three quarters of the battle is actually getting into the break. So I asked Ben Swift of Team UAE how he got into the break, and then, you know, how it broke down at the finish, and he explained why he wasn't in that final move.
BMC was really kind of active. They wanted to have someone in that break, so they looked like a guy's, was it eight man at the start of group went. I thought that was it, and I was like, all right, we'll wait for a sprint. And then they kept chasing and chasing, and then that first cat climb, we went up there really, really quick. I started to move up, and I was like, if I'm moving up on a climb when we're going this fast, I'm not feeling too bad. Got to the front at the top, and then there was a couple of little rollers, followed a little move, a couple of moves, and then someone smashed it down the descent. Next thing, we turned around, and we had 20 guys away, so it happened on the descent, really. So, yeah, and then that was that.
So once you're in it, all working quite well together?
Obviously, the two lotto riders, I think they wanted to sprint with Greipel today, so they weren't really working at the start. But once it became apparent that we were staying away, everybody really worked away. Kuklier tried one little move, but we just straight away just started rolling through again, and it became pretty apparent that with such a strong headwind, nobody was going anywhere until the right combination went.
At what point did you start thinking about the finale and maybe trying to work out what you were going to do?
I think over that Cat 3, really, I really wanted to try and save as much energy up there, and I actually felt pretty good up there, so I thought, this is it now. Obviously, I was a bit concerned about being quite outnumbered with a lot of the teams, so I was just trying to watch like the stronger guys in them teams. But I was just trying to use other guys a bit too much and trying to save my energy, whereas in the past, I've always perhaps gone to work first. You know, if someone's like not followed the line for all, I'll always jump in. So today I really thought I need to try and save a little bit and try and use the other riders and try and be a little bit smarter myself, but it kind of backfired a little bit. I knew that we had a little climb coming up, but the climb that it was, I didn't think that was it. I thought there were going to be another, but it was actually going to be a little steeper. It was almost just like a little bump in the road, so a bit of a bad judgment on my behalf being so far back, because I think with having so many guys, once they knew that their teammates were in front, they just sat up. And then once you've got guys like De Gendt and that going for that hard, it's just so hard to bring it back.
Hi, I'm Tak. I'm staff in the Rafa Clubhouse Osaka. You are listening to the Cycling Podcast Association with Rafa.
The Rafa Cycling Club is the largest global community of its kind. Members share their passion for the road through rides, events, exclusive club kits and racing. Find out more at rafa.cc.
Thank you very much indeed to Rafa, our fantastic sponsor, who don't only support the Cycling Podcast, but also design and produce our great range of Pedalar de Charme clothing. Unfortunately, the jerseys have temporarily sold out. I mean, I say unfortunately, that's fantastic. It's had a great response. It only went on sale at the start of the Tour de France. It will be back in stock soon. We will obviously keep you updated on that. There are still T-shirts and caps available at rafa.cc, also on the shop tab on our own website, thecyclingpodcast.com.
Yeah, and there'll also be some Pedaleurs de Charme jerseys coming. I assume they'll be ready when the reprint or the remake of the Pedaleur de Charme jerseys are
ready. Pedaleurs de Charme kit in women's sizes as well. So that's great. And that's, you know, in response to a lot of you asking for that. And so we're delighted to be able to say that that will be available soon. And thank you very much to all of those who've bought that stuff, because as well as looking absolutely wonderful, you're also supporting the Cycling Podcast by doing so and enabling us to cover the races that we do, like the Tour de France, which is where we are now. And look who it is. Here he is, dispelling the myth that he and Francois are in fact the same person. Daniel!
Daniel plus Tamron.
Let's speak together.
Yeah, speak together, yeah. Both of you at the same time.
Maybe François could do an impression of me.
Ouais, je vais faire une imitation de François Tomazo.
Je suis Marseillais. C'est pas mal.
Well, okay. François was correcting your English a minute ago, Daniel, so you have kind of swapped.
Which word he was correcting. Phrases.
Daniel, we haven't spoken to you for a while. I think when we last spoke to you, we were going over, it seems like a long time ago, I think it was Chambéry we last spoke to you, was it?
Possible, Rich. And I've had all sorts of nuggets that I wanted to share with you in the meantime, but I've forgotten them all.
One was petrol.
One was about petrol.
What was that?
How much do you think a World Tour team spends on petrol a year? This was told to me by a World Tour team manager.
About €500,000?
Oh, funnily enough, Richard. Well, actually, since the price of petrol has gone, well, it sort of spiked at the start of this year, didn't it? And now it's, I think it's gone up about 20% in the last 6 months in Central Europe on average. So now, you know, teams are having to budget for another 200,000 euros for petrol.
All those motorised bikes as well they've got to pay for.
Gosh. Oh, dear.
I didn't know batteries had increased in prices, but never mind.
That's shocking. Anything else you want to share with us, Daniel? Any nuggets?
No, I mean, have you been doing much transfer talk? I've been seeing.
We haven't been doing much transfer talk. You are our transfer man.
What's the latest about Landa? Because we heard about every team was signing Landa next season.
Well, we thought that the Movistar deal was a done deal. Spoke to Eusebio Unzué, the manager of Movistar, the other day. He was adamant that it wasn't. But of course, all team managers, well, they can't reveal who they've signed before August the 1st. And then some rumours, murmurs coming out of the Sky Camp that he may not even be leaving. Which, to me, sounds plausible.
Would they want to lose him? I mean, he's a potential... I think Sky want to win all three Grand Tours, don't they? I think my rumour at the start of the tour that Quintana might go to Sky may not happen. At least Sabio said that he's going to stay till 2018. Quintana said that himself. The other confirmed, I think, today by Laura Messiger was that Mikel Nieve is going to Orica Scott.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting to see whether they look for a like-for-like replacement, because they're obviously signing Jonathan Castroviejo from Movistar, and he's more of a time trialist, also going to be useful in the mountains. And of course, they've got guys to come back in, Wout Poels, and a couple have missed out on this Tour de France. But you would think, looking at the history of Team Sky, they've traditionally been really strong in the mountains, and they would probably look for a replacement, especially as Nieve, I mean, for my money, is has been much more impressive than Henao in this Tour de France. So they will want to look for reinforcements in that area, I would have thought. They're signing a couple of good, very good young riders, Egon Bernal and Sivakov, isn't it? The French-Italian-Russian. Who will now be riding for a British team. Not sure. I think Viviani's going to go. He'll leave Sky.
UAE, possibly, or...
But yeah, he's been linked with UAE. But yeah, I'm not sure what else is happening. I mean, I keep seeing Jerome Pinot in the Zone Technique. He's constantly on his phone. Jerome Pinot, the former Quickstep, I Am Cycling, Bouygues Telecom rider who's setting up a pro continental team next year. Francois probably knows plenty about this.
Yeah, well, I don't know plenty about it, but apparently it's a done thing. He's going to launch his own continental pro team. I don't know exactly with whom, but it seems to be done. There have been rumors that a French team director currently with a Swiss team might join, but as far as I know, they're not on very good terms. So I don't think it will happen. I think Le Danois is, well, it's strictly off the record, but he's been trying to launch his own.
You can't say it then. You can't say it.
Yeah, but it's only for the cycling podcast listeners, you know. Nobody
else.
Put
that bit on
know.
The friends feed.
Nobody
we should introduce a feature. Only all our off the record conversations are available on the friends feed.
Le Danois has been working on a project in France for a couple of years, and he's. I don't know where he's these days, but we'll see. We'll see.
I think, and Pino has he's been strongly linked with Brian Coquart. That's supposedly going to be
They have the same agent, Pino and Coquart.
Okay.
Mm. And Landa's manager, who is, I think he only looks after Landa. I think.
Yeah,
that's
he's a childhood friend.
A childhood friend. He was chatting to Luca Guercellino this morning at Trek.
Dun, dun, dun. Mm. Well, I spoke to Luca Guercellino a few days ago, and he was pretty adamant that his budget is all accounted for next year.
Cannondale's interesting. We heard today that their new sponsor is Oath, which was not a company I was familiar with. Jonathan Watson,
Oath,
they said,
not Oath. Did you say Oath?
Oath. But they're a major media company. I guess the team will not be called Oath. I don't know, but they own HuffPost, Yahoo Sports, and lots of other things. Interesting to see what that will entail, but they've got a lot of riders out of contract at the end of this year. Rigoberto Urán being one of them.
Formolo. Sky were interested in Formolo.
Pierre Roland as well.
Yeah, Sky were interested in Formolo. And the other rider who's out of contract, a climber who I'd be very interested to know where he's going to go. Warren Barguil, of course. Francois, I don't know if you've got any intel on that, but he's another rider who's been linked with Jerome Pinot. Yeah, I think it'd be very wise to stay with somewhere.
No,
in light of
somewhere, but yeah, and he hasn't got the same agent. Roland has got the same agent as Pinot and Coquart, so he might be in the same wavelength, so that might be possible. But I really, from what I heard, Warren Barguil stays with Sunweb for another year at least.
Who's been your? We've talked about Barguil a lot, Daniel. You know Barguil quite well. Is the whimsical flâneur of cycling? Have you managed to finally work out which is Bardet and which is Barguil?
I remembered that today. I remembered that. I'd completely forgotten it. The interview I did with Barguil was 2014 Vuelta, and of course I knew who he was. He had a great record already. He'd won two stages in that Vuelta, and sat down for an interview with him at the team hotel on the penultimate day and proceeded to call him Romain Bardet for 20 minutes. And such an affable young fellow he is. He didn't, I think he felt embarrassed and he didn't point out that I had mistaken his identity until the very end of the interview.
When he said, thank you very much, Lionel Burney. That was a great interview.
He mistook you for Lionel. Yeah.
Easily done. How many wine glasses, Daniel, or do you save that for Twitter?
Well, from a viticultural point of view, it's been a very interesting Tour de France.
I don't think we've had that word yet.
Viticultural, yeah.
We had the stage to Nuit Saint-Georges in Burgundy, which seems like an age ago. We've been through some other very good wine regions. My highlight was my highlight is always the day we spend in Po when I get to drink my favorite French red wine, the kind of hipsters Bordeaux. No, the hipsters Bordeaux is Bergerac, so I had some of that, and then we also had some Madiron in Po. It's very, very powerful tannic French wine. I'm going off a bit of a tangent here. I think it becomes very easy to forget how many dull stages there were, and you think about the ingredients that would have made this a perfect Tour de France. And the battle of Kittel and Cavendish has still never really happened, and it's never really boiled over, and we've never had a situation on a Grand Tour in a season when it's been tit for tat and it's been very close and they've been locking horns regularly, and it still has not happened on this Tour de France. So I think the sprint finishes have been not an anti-climax, they've been interesting enough, but they haven't been classics. And as far as the general classification is concerned, I think there's always a sense of collective disappointment, rightly or wrongly, when the yellow jersey does not pull off some kind of race-defining exploit and win a stage. Chris Froome is still yet to win a stage. It has been very close, but you know, we're seeing that more and more with major tours, and major tour organisers are going out of their way to maintain the suspense until the last day, and they're doing it very successfully. They're doing that mainly by reducing the number of kilometres of time trialing, and because the time gaps in the mountains now are so small. I personally like the lack of summit finishes. I think it makes for much more interesting tactical racing. The stage to Chambry when Richie Porte crashed, terribly unfortunate for him, and it deprived us of a real protagonist in the race. But you know, that comes about because of a really interesting, really difficult, not only physically, but mentally and in terms of skill, difficult course. And, you know, that should be part of the Tour de France.
I mean, already we could see when Richie Porte crashed out that he was, at that point, the equal of the others. You thought that he was maybe peaked in terms of his form. But imagine a scenario where he hadn't crashed out and he had been in the same position. It would have forced Chris Froome to race in a different way, probably. But going into this final time trial with Richie Porte and Chris Froome seconds apart would have made tomorrow's stage far more interesting and tantalising than it is at the moment.
No, I agree, Richard. And I think in that we've said many times before that there needs to be room for skill, and it shouldn't just be about who the strongest rider is. I mean, when there were debates in the first and second week about waiting for the yellow jersey, not waiting for the yellow jersey, certainly Chris Froome said to me, I think people want to see the strongest rider win. Yes, but I think they should also want to see the rider who negotiates the course best win, and the rider who has the best team, which is the case for Froome. And it's this whole constellation of factors which I think should add up to the spectacle we eventually get from the Tour de France. And I think it's been a good race in that respect. It's not just been about one rider crushing the race with superior physical ability. There have been a whole series of factors that have put Chris Froome where he is at the moment, and going into the decisive penultimate day, still not certain to win the Tour de France.
Great to see Daniel again, wasn't it? He's still got it.
He has, yeah. I mean, you know, he's
a bit rusty, but
yeah, but you know, he's probably been watching from the sidelines, seeing how well Francois performed this month, and thinking, well, I maybe need to play my way back into the team.
To be honest, he sounded like he'd been doing the cycling podcast forever. So,
oh, that's wonderful. Praise from Francois. That's great. No, he did okay there. He did okay. I mean,
badly missed Daniel. We you know,
of course, we missed Daniel.
Yeah, we'd love to have him back in the team,
back in the fold. Well, he will be. Once we return to Blighty and leave Francois in Marseille, which is what we're doing tonight. What I should have said before Daniel interrupted us there was that we did present a couple of our wonderful Pedlar de Charme t-shirts at the start this morning. I say we presented them. Very grateful to Laura Messiger of Eurosport for presenting Alberto Contador with his. Unfortunately, I had to leave, so she fulfilled that task and did so very well. Thank you, Laura, for that. Orla Chinoui gave Warren Barguil his t-shirt. Alberto Contador was the winner of the Pedlar de Charme poll, but it was so incredibly close. They were actually on the same percentage, Barguil and Contador, that we decided to award two T-shirts. I think that was the only right thing to do.
Yeah, well, you know, there's only one winner in cycling. I mean, Edvald Boasson-Hagen deserved to win the other day, and he finally won. So, okay, I accept your explanation for Barguil's t-shirt.
And Alberto Contador goes home with something from the 27th Tour de France, right. 2017 Tour de France. Well done, Alberto.
He'll probably put a red bib, you know, on his Pedal de Charme t-shirt for his Prix de la Combativité.
Yeah, can you have combative, charming pedaling? I guess you can.
Well, clearly a lot of our listeners thought so, Lionel, because they voted for him in large numbers to be our Pedal de Charme.
The cycling podcast is supported by Science in Sport.
Hello, my name is James Morton. I'm the head of nutrition for Team Sky. I'm also a reader in exercise metabolism at Liverpool John Moores University. And last but not least, the world-class knowledge director for Science in Sport.
The extra feeds are a very important part of Team Sky's nutritional approach, really, because when you think about it, feeding should be quite simple, but actually the logistics and the terrain of the profile mean that sometimes you can't get access to foods. So we'll look at every route, we'll break down each stage, and we'll think about the optimal periods in that particular stage to feed. We'll have a whole team of staff on race doing the extra feeds, and hopefully if all things go to plan, we shouldn't get to the last 10k in a state where we've underfueled, really. We could have 4, 5, 6 extra feeds over a 180, 200 kilometre stage, really. Basically, we're trying to feed every 20 minutes or so. And if we can't feed every 20 minutes, then we try and double up at the next available opportunity. But if you break down the profile and the terrain, then you can place your extra feeds at the correct times to coincide with 20-minute feeds. I think you've got to get the balance between safety from feeding and safety from logistics on the road. First and foremost, it's safety first, really, isn't it? It's about safety for the riders, and that can mean safety from extra vehicles on the road, but it also means safety from people going hypoglycemic, for instance, or dehydrating. But if riders feed from the very beginning of the stage rather than almost backloading the stage, the end of the stage will take care of itself. And we spend a lot of time reminding riders that feeding starts well before the stage starts, actually. And then if you feed regularly throughout the stage, everything should take care of itself.
Hello, I'm Serge Powels from Team Dimension Data.
For me, I wasn't really thinking too much about it. Yeah, that was the day we had Stevie in the front, so there was a car. One of the two cars was always with him, and then the other one stayed closer to the gruppetto or the guys behind. So I was always a little bit stuck in the middle. I was able to take a bottle of the doctor on top of the Port de Balais, so just before. But then I got a bit thirsty in the last hour again, and when the car from that was behind Stevie came back, I asked for a bottle, but I wasn't really realizing how close it was to the finish, because it wasn't really a lot in kilometers, but as it was uphill, it was still quite a far end. So yeah, I'm not in top 10 in GC, so okay, I was not really worried about, I wasn't even thinking about penalty or seconds or whatever, but I think honestly, yeah, it was initially a correct decision from the jury to give a penalty, so I accepted it, no problem at all. And afterwards they cancelled it because of the special circumstance, and it was quite hot anyway, and it was a bit of a strange last final, you know. I think they want to keep a little bit of control of the mess that can exist when cars are in between riders in the last 10k, so there needs to be the rules, you know. So for me, it wasn't a big deal. I think it was more it was a bigger thing for the real GC contenders, of course.
The cycling podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you to our sponsor, Science in Sport. We heard a little feature there on something that's been talked about in this tour, the rule that forbids feeding in the final 20 kilometres of a flat stage and the final 10 kilometres of a mountain stage. And we heard there from one of the riders, Serge Powels, who was actually penalised for feeding in the final 10 kilometres of the stage. It finished up the, what climb was it? Just above Luchon?
Perigueux.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so quite interesting perspective from him, because he, you know, gave some valid reasons for why that rule exists. But yeah, we're very grateful to Science and Sport, and a reminder that you can get 20% off at scienceandsport.com by entering the code CPOD20. Now, at the start this morning, I grabbed a word with a friend of the podcast, or podcast favourite, Aymar Zubeldia, who, during this Tour de France, announced his imminent retirement. His final race will be the San Sebastian Classic next week, which goes almost past his home. He's a Basque rider who's been around for a long, long time. He was actually a last-minute call-up to the Tour after his teammate Andre Cardoso tested positive for EPO on the eve of the Tour. Now, Zubeldia was actually, he is the pro's pro, and he was delighted to be called up. Some wouldn't be so happy at getting a late call-up for the Tour, but he had been hoping to ride it anyway, and he was happy to be here riding in support mainly of Alberto Contador. So I spoke to Zubeldi at the finish. Here's what he had to say.
I feel strange, no? But also a lot of friends from the bunch, they give me congrats, and I feel proud of that, no?
When did you make the decision to retire?
During the last years, the decision are making more important, but especially this year, no? You feel also with the years, and this year I talk about that a lot with my family, all my old friends, and finally I took the decision.
I think you were with your family, weren't you, when you got the late call to come and ride the Tour de France?
Yeah, because I come here in the last moment. But it was nice for me also because I want to be here. Also, it was a dream for me to do the Tour and Clásica San Sebastián and finish my career there. I see now my dream can be true, no?
Have you enjoyed your final Tour de France?
Of course, I suffer a lot also, but when you have a decision in the mind also, you enjoy another way.
I remember you were a marshal at the Tour de France when it was in San Sebastián in 1992, weren't you, when you were very young? So you'll finish your career in San Sebastián. The race will go more or less past your house.
Always was a dream for me to finish in San Sebastián because San Sebastián is my home race. And when I was young, I was there looking my heroes, and now I finished my career there, and I'm happy for that.
Hi, Mar Zubeldia there. One of the friendliest riders in the peloton, I think. He's had a very long career, a lot of it in the service of others. But we know him, of course, for sneaking into the top 10 on Grand Tours. And we've had some comment from people to the effect that we're sort of taking the mickey a little bit out of him for our a la Zubeldia.
No,
but
no.
We're not. I mean, you know, you're right. If you're finishing the top 10 of a Grand Tour, you're a very strong rider.
In 1988, they'd have called it the Eric Boyer Award because he snuck into fifth position without appearing on television once, I think, from memory.
I think probably Marino Lajarreta was number one sneaker, you know, because he actually rode probably more Grand Tours than Adam Hansen and made a couple of top five.
He often rode all three in a year, didn't he?
He did.
He made a bit of a speciality of
absolutely. That. Absolutely. And who knows his face. I mean, he had a very distinctive face, mind you, Marino Lajarreta, so you could recognize him. But yeah, Aymar Zubeldia belongs to that category of, very dedicated, hard fighting and kind of withdrawn Grand Tour riders and he's a great guy as well. So yeah, well, plaudits to him.
Well, we wish him the best of luck. I forgot to ask him what he's going to do in retirement. You said he was going to spend time with his family. I think he's got daughters actually. He lives a little village up the coast from San Sebastián. I went and met him a couple of years ago there, and we did a little bit of a podcast special on Basque cycling.
I'm thinking he might have a career as a private investigator, you know, something that requires staying in the shadows, not being spotted from a distance. Hi, Aymar Zubeldia, PI. I think this could be commissioned as a TV show.
Well, yeah, and he could investigate the world of cycling because, you never know. There might still be things to investigate. Who knows? Maybe it's too well known by the riders, mind you. But, yeah, an idea.
Oh, but seriously, I mean, sneaking, I like this phrase, sneaking, sneaker, the sneakers, but sneaking into the top 10, I mean, it's not easy to do.
I mean, if I sneaked into the top 10 of the Tour de France, I'd be very happy
exactly.
about it.
I mean, when you look at the top 10, I mean, all bar, really, Louis Menkes have been very visible in the race, so it's actually quite an achievement.
Well,
Louis Menkes gets the Aymar Zubeldia Award this year.
He does, definitely.
And maybe Damiano Caruso managed to sneak just out of the top 10.
Yeah, he's got 4 minutes to make up on, or even more, 5 minutes to make up on Contador tomorrow in the time trial. Unlikely to happen. But, it's an affectionate thing. It's not mocking somebody for being extremely good at cycling.
No, that's it.
There's another
well
rider who's even closer than Zubeldia to retire, and that's Thomas Vauclair. I had a few words with him this morning. I mean, I didn't record them because he was a kind of...
Daniel would have recorded it.
Yeah, he would have. I'm sorry about that. No, but because we talked in French and, there was lots of guys around. And he said it's funny because he doesn't want to talk to the press. He doesn't want to be recorded. I mean, it's been very difficult to get interviews with Thomas Vauclair, but you couldn't get chit-chat with him quickly. And he was saying that he keeps a brave face, but you can tell it's hard. You know, he feels the end is coming.
Well,
and he was trying to be humorous this morning by saying, by saying, 60,000 people are coming to my retirement party, which is the case tomorrow. And you know, it's a little kind of humor, but you could tell he was saying it with a kind of a, you know, keeping a brave face. It made up, you know, that joke,
but
you know,
it's very before. Funny though that you bring up Vauclair, because they are complete opposites, Zubeldia and Vauclair. Zubeldia spent his career, a lot of it, helping others, but other, you know, when he's ridden well, he's not really attracted attention, whereas Vauclair's gone out of his way to attract attention and has been the master of the, you know, the TV attack. I mean, he's a very good rider as well, obviously, but he's an exhibitionist. He's a showman, isn't he? And Zubeldia will, I imagine, just slip quietly into retirement.
Yeah, Vauclair made the best of very little potential, I think, and Zubeldia did very little with probably a much higher potential. That's
well
the difference.
Put.
Yeah.
I mean, Vauclair's very, very popular, though, isn't he? I mean, he's...
Still.
Yeah, you know, tremendous cheers every morning when he comes out of the Direct Energy bus. But there's definitely a sense that he has been eclipsed absolutely and definitively in this tour, because a couple of years ago, he really was the star of French cycling. But now with Warren Barguil, Romain Bardet, of course, and even Lilian Calmejean, who's coming up quickly. You know, France has now got plenty to celebrate, plenty to cheer. And, yeah, it must be tough for Vauclair, because he hasn't had a great tour. And the glorious send-off would be to get into a break and then finish it off and win a stage. But that's never really looked on the cards for him.
It's funny, because the day Lilian Calmejean won in Les Rousses, almost all the Direct Energy riders came out of the bus, who were you know, in great spirits, talking to the press. Sylvain Chavanel was talking to anybody, you know, who was asking questions. And the only one who didn't come out of the bus was Thomas Vauclair. You had the impression he was kind of crossed by this this victory, because it proved that, you know, the baton had been passed. You know, it was kind of finished for him.
A tough moment for a rider like him, right? We should wrap things up, finally, because Francois is actually disappearing off to Marseille tonight. He's sleeping, not in his own bed, but not far away from it. That sounds a bit dodgy, but he's staying at his father's, because somebody's staying in his flat. But we'll meet up with you again tomorrow, Francois, obviously.
Sure, absolutely.
And tomorrow's a time trial. What do we expect?
Well, I think we expect the GC... I think we expect Chris Froome to win the Tour de France. I think we expect Rigoberto Urán to jump up from third to second over Romain Bardet. But I think we wonder whether there's going to be any kind of upset in those 22.5 kilometres. But the problem is, unfortunately, we're in the situation where we are the only drama is going to come from a mechanical or from a crash. It's not going to come from, you know, a tremendous swing in terms of, you know, one rider being much stronger than another over the course of the even if somebody misjudges that climb dramatically, they're probably not going to lose. You know, Chris Froome's not going to lose enough to threaten his yellow jersey. I think what Daniel said was very true about if Richie Porte had been in the Tour. Sorry, it was you, Richard.
I know we've been sort of overwhelmed by the sheer presence of Daniel.
I think
but
the point
he doesn't say all the good stuff.
The point that you made, Richard, in the presence of Daniel was very perceptive. In that, had Richie Porte still been in the race, you would imagine that Chris Froome and Richie Porte would be very close together, and then you would see a battle between two, you know, very good time trialists on a short, explosive course. Where, because it's short and explosive, there is potential for sort of misjudgment by either going out too fast and then paying for it on the climb. Because the way listening to Thierry Gouvenou in the kilometre zero, and about the way he wants the teams and the riders to be uncomfortable and under threat and in doubt at every moment of the tour, the way that course is designed is quite clever, because the temptation to go out hard and fast on the flat and then possibly pay for that effort on the climb, it is a trap, potentially. The time gaps are enough that it could be a trap, but it's the wrong order of riders. If you had Romain Bardet or Rigoberto Urán ahead of Chris Froome, you could be in for an absolute grandstander, but I just don't see that happening.
There's another question, I mean, and that's an important one. Will Chris Froome win a stage on this Tour de France? It's his last chance, unless he sprints for victory on the Champs-Élysées, which I doubt, but because obviously we saw today that the sprinters didn't even try to chase the break, because they're all, you know, saving energy for the big day on the Champs-Élysées. So will Chris Froome win the time trial tomorrow? Well, normally he's one of the best specialists, and the course seems to suit him. But you cannot rule out, you know, all the team directors I talked to, and even Maxime Bouet, who's from Marseille, I talked to him this morning, said this is really for a specialist, for a real great time trial specialist. Well, if that's the case, I mean, we can't rule out, riders like Tony Martin or Stefan Kung, who were second in the young Swiss Ofel, who was second in the first stage, to try to, you know, maybe steal the show and maybe stop Chris Froome from winning the stage on this tour. I talked to Yvon Le Danois with Stefan Kung's team director, and he has great hopes for the Swiss rider tomorrow. Well, let's listen maybe to Yvon
Le Danois.
I mean, for her, this is one big objective for the team BMC, for him also. Everybody up one good result for tomorrow. We ask him today and tomorrow also keep energy for this TT. You have a real chance for one good result. We look tomorrow, but you never know. You never know with Froome, with the leader, and with Stefan, I think he has a real chance for one good result more.
He was very close in the first stage in Dusseldorf, very, very close. So I guess he wants revenge now.
Yeah, but tomorrow it's a little bit different with the climb. Notre Dame, it's a hard climb, but it's not the long climb. So I don't think it's one problem for Stefan tomorrow.
Is it really for a specialist, for a ruler, in spite of the wind, in spite of the climb?
Yeah. I mean, we saw him in the stage and the mountain. He can't pass the mountain, so this climb tomorrow is not one problem for him.
So Yvon Le Danois, Stefan Kung, a good shout for tomorrow. And, you know, interesting, none of the time trial specialists went in the break today. Someone like Tony Martin might have been up for that, but they were obviously keeping their powder dry for tomorrow. You were just mentioning, Lionel, that, you know, Froome, if he doesn't win tomorrow, it'd be the first... And if he doesn't win on the Champs-Élysées, it'd be the first tour winner not to win a stage since Oscar Pereiro in 2006, who obviously won in very strange circumstances. Yep. And before that, Greg LeMond in 1990.
And before that, only four other times. Lucien Aymar in 66, Gastone Nencini in 1960, Roger Walkowiak, of course, in 56, and Firmin Lambeau in 1922. So it used to be a real big thing, didn't it? Winning the tour without winning a stage... was kind of frowned upon, particularly by the fans.
Kind of shameful, like, you know, it's kind of... But once again, given we discussed the course and the route many times, but given the course designed by Thierry Gouvenou, maybe it was bound to happen. No big time trial, no major mountain stage and uphill finish. It was exactly the kind of course that would suit, make this possible. And Chris Froome said from the very beginning it was one of the biggest challenges in his career, because there was not that stage that you could actually target and say, that's when I'm going to win the tour. So, we were talking about Richie Porte missing the final time trial. I can't help but thinking, I said it probably on the first day and I repeated on almost the last day, the Tour de France for me as well has been a very strange example of what cycling has become. In the old days, all the best riders in the world would have done anything to be on the Tour. There was no kind of competition with the Giro, the Vuelta. Very few of the top riders, you know, could afford missing the Tour. It's changed a little bit, and of course Richie Paul will not be competing tomorrow in Marseille, but I keep regretting that with Tom Dumoulin, Vincenzo Nibali, Adam Yates,
even Thibaut Pinot,
Thibaut Pinot didn't actually ride this tour. And with this course and these riders, on this Tour de France, we would have probably had one of the greatest tours ever.
On that note. We will reconvene tomorrow.
What might have been?
In Marseille, in the Stade Vélodrome. We'll look forward to it. In the meantime, thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Francois.
Thank you, Richard.